Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. This episode of Screen Talk is brought to you by Vimeo. By now, I hope you know that Vimeo has a bunch of amazing indie films you can watch on demand. I've recommended my favorites you can check out at vimeo.com/IndieWire. If you're a filmmaker and want to sell your movie or series on Vimeo on demand, all you need is a pro account. You can set your own price, create promo codes, add bonus features, and there's that embeddable HD player with a purchase button, which means people can buy and watch your film anywhere on the web. Vimeo only takes 10%, which is the best in the business. Go to vimeo.com/startselling and use the promo code ERIC20 for 20% off Vimeo Pro. This week, I'm recommending the Oscar-nominated short films. No, not the ones for this year's race, because we don't know what those are yet. These are the ones from last year, but guess what? They're really great. I especially like the animated shorts, but really last year's crop overall was great in the live action documentaries, so you should check out all that stuff. Use the ERIC20 promo code. You'll get a 20% discount, and you can let me know what you think. But for now, on with the show.
IndieWire's weekly podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the deputy editor and chief film critic, joined by Ann Thompson from Thompson in Hollywood, who's still on the West Coast, but a little further north than usual. Isn't that right?
Yes, I'm in Bend, Oregon, at a regional film festival that's been around for a few years, and they've been trying to get me to come up here for a while, and I just thought, okay, I can go up for the weekend. You know, look at some documentaries. I'm on the jury with Paula Bernstein, which is nice because she lives in Oregon now and I get to hang out with her.
Well, it's certainly a change of scenery from the last time we spoke when you were in town for the New York Film Festival, but I'm still here and the festival is still going.
It seems like the longest festival in the history of the universe, I have to say.
It's funny because
it seems like a long time since I was there.
The Seattle Film Festival, where we actually came up with the idea for our podcast, is about the same amount of time.
That's
but
true.
New York Film Festival is a really particular beast in the sense that every weekend brings a new load of stuff. I mean, there are a lot of stuff that's played elsewhere, but a lot of sort of tidbits that are filling in gaps and so forth. And the last time we spoke, we hadn't seen one of the major fall movies that's in New York Film Festival this year, Steven Spielberg's Bridge of Spies.
So now which we I got to see that. In Los Angeles.
That's right. You still have to hit a screening at the exact same time. But yeah, we've been anticipating that one for a while, trying to see if it was going to shake up the Oscar race. And I guess the way that I would summarize it, and you can tell me if I'm on the right track here, is yeah, it's pretty good. It's kind of a contender, but it didn't completely change the game in any particular way.
I have to say, I like the movie very much, and it's exactly what you expect it to be. It's yep. Incredibly well mounted. There's some amazing sequences. I think specifically of one where a young man is riding a bicycle alongside the Berlin Wall that is being constructed at that moment.
Right.
And so, you know, that's a pretty beautiful sequence. And there's another sequence where the elevated train goes across the top of the wall after it's constructed, and the guards are you know, riddling people with bullets as they try to cross, you know, that kind of thing. So he knows how to ratchet up the stakes, and he knows how to create this extraordinary everyman played by Tom Hanks. And there's so many things good about the movie at the same time that it's very stately and old-fashioned and sort of nothing extraordinarily new, and there are many who will appreciate its virtues,
right.
and I'm one of them.
I mean, it's a movie that could have been made very similarly 50 years ago. In fact, it was a project that was in the works many decades ago with, I think, Alec Guinness supposed to play this role of a Russian spy that has now gone to Mark Rylance.
Well, there's something very Jean Le Carré about this.
That's true.
It's not that far away from something like Tinker Tailor, and it's very much in the universe of the Cold War or a great, Michael Caine, Harry Palmer movie like The Ypres File or something. And I love it, but I as I went through my Oscar chart, trying really, objectively to see where it fits. Is it going to knock various people out of contention? If we look at a list of best picture contenders and there's 10 of them, perhaps we have no way of knowing how many there will be. It would certainly be a factor, I think, on a long list like that. But if you go into the director race or the actor race, I'm not so sure. As good as Tom Hanks is, I think there are other people who are probably ahead of him.
Well, he's
And
very Tom Hanksy. I mean, you can't wrestle free of some of the restrictions of that. The last time Spielberg had a great actor in the Oscar race was Daniel Day-Lewis with Lincoln, and it was a chameleon-esque performance. He really became this guy. Tom Hanks is playing that kind of Tom Hanks character where, I mean, he's kind of flawless in a way. This
he's
good-natured
good.
lawyer, a very good person, but of course he is. He's Tom Hanks, and I think that
He's
there's,
perfectly cast,
but Mark
and
Rylance,
but
again,
it's a
Rylance is
he
terrific.
may get in. That's where I'm. I mean, I haven't. We've talked about how crowded the supporting actor race is, but I could definitely see the Academy sort of saying, okay, we like Mark
Right. I mean,
Rylance,
he's not an actor. He's done a bunch of movies. If you've seen Wolf Hall, you know his face, and he's been on
And
the
he was
stage.
overlooked by the Emmys, I thought tragically, because he's an amazing theater actor. Anyone who's seen Jerusalem, for example, or the all-woman Twelfth Night that he did, which was amazing. He's an amazing actor, so people respect him. And I could, but I think production design, Adam Stockhausen, who won for Grand Budapest last year, he could definitely get in. It's stunning work in terms of the period,
And
and that's the
Vilmos.
beautiful thing about it. Spielberg's really conjuring up this period that he grew up in and remembers, that time of being terrified by
Right.
duck and cover,
The nuclear paranoia comes through pretty well. There are a lot of individual scenes that I think are some of the sharpest Spielberg's done in a while, including the first 10 minutes of the movie, which are nearly wordless. And I thought some of the best directed scenes of any movie this year. The rest of the movie is much more traditional by comparison, but there's some great stuff there. Spielberg is still delivering terrific cinema in a lot of, kind of small doses. But it's a movie worth talking about. But to go back to
I'm
Mark,
curious to see how well it does at the box office and how long it sustains,
it's not an easy sell. I mean, if you look at the trailer, I just don't know. I mean, one of the things they're missing when they're in marketing this movie is that it's actually pretty funny. I mean, the Coen brothers wrote the screenplay, and there are some really witty moments involving the kind of weirdly Kafkaesque journey that Tom Hanks' character makes to Berlin, where he's kind of working for the government, but it's officially not working for the government, and everybody's trying to kind of mess with his head a little bit. I mean, it's surprisingly funny, wouldn't you say?
Definitely, and there's this sort of routine thing where Tom Hanks keeps saying to Rylance, aren't you nervous? Aren't you worried about this? And the guy says, would it do any good?
Would it help? Yeah,
Would
would
it
it
help?
help? That would be on a
Would it
t-shirt
help?
or
So
something.
I actually think, though, that there's an interesting disconnect there between the script and the world that Spielberg creates. I wonder if the Coens didn't write this with a different tone, a consistent tone that I could imagine the Coen universe that script belongs in, if you see what
Right.
I mean.
It would be a much more of a screwball take
It
on
would
all
be
this stuff.
lighter. And
Well,
it would have that skew. It would have that funny skew that they sometimes have.
I think Spielberg is
Whereas
almost,
Spielberg's more straight
oh
on,
yeah, insincere, and on some level, he's trying to make his Argo in a way. I mean, the final beats of the movie are actually very similar to Argo. It's a celebration of this all-American man and what he stands for,
And it's a true story,
and it's a true
and it really
story.
happened. There's some nice little touches like the theater marquee in German, Ein, zwei, drei, which refers to the Billy Wilder movie 1, 2, 3, which was set
Well,
in Berlin.
I was talking to Dana Harris, our editor-in-chief, about this because we saw the movie together, and Billy Wilder would have done a great version of this story.
Incredible,
So
incredible. It made me want to go back and see that movie.
it's actually kind of nice to see Spielberg, outside of all the awards conversations, is really one of the only filmmakers who seems to work in that register as almost a classical Hollywood filmmaker. but not in an antiquated way. I mean, it's a very involving movie. It doesn't look like it's out of touch just because it's, you know, dated in terms of the kind of story that it's telling. I mean,
not at all. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful movie. So you were around also to see how Steve Jobs played at the New York Film Festival, and they've been doing a bit of a swing through Los Angeles as well. They had a big screening, an Academy screening last night with Boyle and Sorkin on hand. I'm just curious what your sense was, if you could read. I mean, we know it played well at Telluride, but that's one group.
Right. It's actually very interesting to compare the Telluride / Next Festival reaction that happened to Spotlight with the one for Steve Jobs, because Spotlight played at Telluride and then it went to Toronto. This one played at Telluride and then it was a New York Film Festival. So I kind of thought, well, Steve Jobs hasn't played anywhere for a while. It's going to get a huge boost of attention from New York Film Festival, and I assumed it was going to play really, really well. It sounded like it was a little bit more divided. I mean,
that's how it played in LA. That's exactly what happened. It's not mainstream in the usual way that would. And let me put it another way: the Academy breaks down into many different groups, and the mainstream critics would be equivalent to the smartest craftspeople and the filmmakers and the writers and like that. So the mainstream of the Academy, this is not necessarily for them. It's a little adventurous for them.
But it's not just that. I mean, it's also a movie that just doesn't work for everybody in the same way. And there are a lot of people, I think, who took issue with the Sorkin script. Other folks who found issues with either the ending or just the general structure of the movie seeming too theatrical, which, I mean, it would be a great stage play. There's a lot going on there
They have said, the actors have said how much fun it would be since they had to memorize all that dialogue. And I would love to see that. I think it's probably a logistical problem. I would love to see them get everybody together for a reading. That would be awesome.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it makes you wonder all these different variables that could have gone wrong. I mean, not to say that it is a perfect movie, because it's fascinating in its flaws, just like Jobs was, but there are certain ingredients that could have thrown it off even more so. Like, Christian Bale was going to play this role. Who knows what Christian Bale's Steve Jobs was like? Supposedly he couldn't find the character, right? But Fassbender it's just not distracting. I don't think he's showboating. Even though it's a big performance, he's buried in this guy. It's really, really convincing in a way that you usually don't see on a movie on this scale, because there is something about kind of putting a movie star in a movie so that they can be that movie star. He's not.
Not Fassbender. That's not the kind of actor that he is.
Yeah.
And I think that Winslet, I think the two of them are actually the front runners in their category. Whatever happens to Steve, I mean, I'm pretty confident that Steve Jobs is going to be an Oscar contender in many, many categories at the end of the day. But I'm totally confident that those two actors are at the front of their respective categories right now.
But people also like Danny Boyle. I mean, I moderated a thing with him on Monday night at Lincoln Center, and just seeing the kind of mania surrounding him, and he's so charming. I mean,
people love him. They adore him, and I think he did a great job. I was reading, there's a story in the Hollywood Reporter which goes into detail. It sort of calls all the emails and all the stuff that was revealed about
the sordid history.
Yes, exactly. We have more information about how this movie got made than any other movie in the history of the universe because of the Sony hack, you know. So it's much more fun and dramatic. And but you know, if you go through the winding trail, I think that it came out very well. I think that finally, right. And by the way, I just want to celebrate Donna Langley yet again. She's the one who pulled the trigger on this. Now, granted, she had a wind at her sails. You know, you want a film, you want a studio chief taking chances when you have Jurassic World,
right.
And you have all that stuff behind you.
It was almost a one for them, one for me sort of situation.
Yeah.
Right?
So, but she also backed. You know, I interviewed Guillermo del Toro the other day. She also backed Crimson Peak, which was a totally. You know, that's a movie that breaks every rule of what's considered Hollywood commercial movie making, and I think it may prove to support all those rules when it doesn't do any business. But I grant her that she actually did that. too.
You just keep breaking that embargo in Crimson Peak.
I don't. When does that embargo? People want to know what the rules of embargo are.
It's weird that, I mean, I know other people who saw it and liked it too. It's strange that word isn't out sooner. There was a sneak peek at Fantastic Fest last weekend, and yet everyone was sworn to silence. So it's still kind of waiting for the word to get out there on that one. But we'll see.
They must be afraid that there's negative word, because otherwise there's no reason for this kind of behavior.
Well, in any case, Steve Jobs is an interesting gamble, but it seems like opening this weekend, it's probably going to do pretty damn well. I mean, interest is high, right? People want to watch a movie about Steve Jobs. Even if he has a complex reputation, we still treasure our iPhones. They're everywhere.
No, people are fascinated by him. We'll see. We will see. It is an unconventional movie. It is a movie that pushes the boundaries of what we can see. People have internalized, everyone has internalized certain rules of how movies are supposed to look and behave, and this one breaks them in a big way.
Well, I'll tell you another movie that's potentially a part of the Best Picture race, because it's been thrown around in that capacity, that also played at New York Film Festival and I think played even better, was Son of Saul. Okay, and this is a movie about
which isn't in the proper New York Film Festival, I might add.
It's a film comment slot, right? So the selection committee as a whole did not choose it, but everybody I've spoken to who saw it in the context of New York Film Festival is doing somersaults over this thing. It's a tremendous experience.
Well, we've been saying this for a long time. Yeah. This is one of the best movies we've seen in years, not just this year. I mean, it's so far away above everything else.
It's groundbreaking in terms of how it tackles its subject matter, and it's also incredibly involving just as a piece of filmmaking. It's just really suspenseful, and it's a great debut feature. But it's amazing to hear people talk about it as enthusiastically as they are now, because it does make you wonder, maybe this really is a serious Best Picture contender, even though it's also in the foreign language race where it should be a slam dunk.
I agree with you. The Sony Pictures Classics has every intention. They're opening it in 2015 instead of waiting until later, and they're going for it. They're going to go for the actor. They're going to go for the director. You know what? The best chance it might have is in the director branch, because that group is very foreign, very, very international, and very high-minded, and they often will vote for a foreign filmmaker.
And Laszlo Nimes has been making the rounds. He just was in New York and said he was going off to L.A. next, just signed with UTA, wants to make an American movie. So he's got a lot of reasons to be shaking hands and taking meetings anyway. So the pieces are aligned pretty strongly in favor of this possibility.
And it's a question of getting people to watch the movie, even though Holocaust movies are supposedly, you know, easy marks for the Academy. I think it's still it's going to be tough to get people to watch it.
Well,
that's all.
There's the Son of Saul challenge, and then there's the Beast of No Nation challenge, right?
Same thing, exactly. Yeah. The same.
But Son of Saul, I think, in some ways has it better, not just because the Holocaust is an easier access point and there are some questionable racial issues involved there, but I think with Beast of No Nation, it's a much longer movie, but also it's just more grisly. The violence is more graphic. Son of Saul is more just sort of unsettling, because you're in a concentration camp the whole time and there's awful stuff happening, but it's not that graphically the violence is as intense as it is just sort of, it's haunting and ghostly in a way, and that's something that is a challenge. But it seems like dark movies tend to do well in Oscar season, right? I mean, Black Swan or Birdman, these are not, you know.
Well, Birdman was, and Black Swan, I would argue, were hugely entertaining, and even and 12 Years a Slave, as difficult as it was.
That's a better point of comparison.
Yeah, I think so, because that was one that people resisted seeing also, but they had to in the end. It was a must-see, and it became a must-see, so they had to go.
Well, we'll see how it plays as it keeps moving around. In the meantime, it's not the only film in the foreign language race, and just this week we got the full list of the
81 movies, which is actually two less than last year, which was the record of 83 movies. We'll see if Ukraine, which missed its deadline or something, gets their movie extension.
They got a lot of stuff to deal with over in Ukraine right now, so they deserve an
They're distracted.
But
China China, that was interesting. They submitted Wolf Totem, as they said they would, and then the Academy rejected it because it didn't have enough elements from its host country. It's directed by Jean-Jacques Annaud, and a lot of his team came over to make the movie. So even though it was funded by the Chinese and it was in China, Mongolian dialect, it wasn't considered Chinese enough. So they had to submit something else.
Gosh, that's just such a bizarre, blurry distinction. But
People are really freaked out, I noticed, by the idea that Mustang would be submitted by France, even though it's a Turkish language film. The rules of the game have to do with how many of the players making the movie come from the country. All it has to be is a foreign language. So an Irish film submitted by Ireland is in Spanish. Having been shot in Cuba.
Right, and there are some downsides to that. I mean, I remember a few years ago when The Band's Visit didn't qualify because there was too much English, even though it was a movie about Israelis and Palestinians trying to communicate, and they have to speak in English to communicate, so it was a very much, international kind of problem. But
so they're very literal about films being, and there has to be a certain percentage that is not in English.
I'm curious to see how many of these movies Academy voters actually check out, because there's some edgy stuff in there. Good Night Mommy from Austria.
Very strange submission, I have to say. They can kiss that one goodbye.
maybe James Franco's Peace for Us gave it an extra boost or something. Anything's possible.
I'm sure that movie is worth seeing, and especially for horror film buffs. Yeah, it's very
intense.
Disturbing.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not an easy sell in any respect. The Clan, which I just saw in Toronto from Pablo Trapero, now that's a pretty impressive movie, and he's a pretty well-liked figure in the Latin American cinema world. And
so that was an even bigger hit than Wild Tales, which was a huge hit.
Right,
so
it had a studio releasing it overseas.
That would be a strong contender, I would suggest.
I think it's got
Deseo, El Deseo, the Almodovar people behind it as well.
Yeah, so I hope people get a chance to see it before year's end in a bigger sense, because he's a terrific filmmaker, and this is a nice kind of evolution of his style. So it was exciting to see that one in there. The Second Mother is still in there. You've been a fan of that one for a while, so maybe that'll get a little bit more traction.
Accessible as Mustang is. In the end, I think France made the right choice. They picked the movie that will play the best, I think, of that group that they were considering.
But there's just so many things here as you go through the list that are just sort of like...
That's normal.
It's normal, but it's so bizarre. You spend a year looking at international cinema, and a lot of this stuff doesn't reflect the kind of experiences that a film festival traveler has. I mean, Arabian Nights, great, Volume 2, I mean, it's just... a lot of it just seems like there's some kind of disconnect between the good movies of the year around the world and how these countries tend to prioritize what they're putting out there.
They always make very strange decisions. It's really too bad that Phoenix isn't eligible this year. They put it up last year and it wasn't submitted.
And it did so well when it got a
wide release.
It's
such a huge hit that it would just be, a very popular entry, it turns out. We'll see. I actually think Embrace of the Serpent from Colombia, which is a festival hit, will do well. And those are the films. I've often wondered if it wouldn't be better to consider festival success as a really important way of judging which films to submit, because I think if you look at the list, the ones that have been submitted that do have festival success behind them are the most likely ones to go through to the end.
Well, it's an interesting suggestion too, because with short films you have film festivals that are Oscar qualifying, in the sense that if a short film plays there it qualifies for the Oscar, right? So you'd think that there would be some way to build in a rule in film festivals that could help foreign language films stand out more or become a part of this race by virtue of something, an audience prize maybe? I don't know. I mean,
it's an interesting, that's a good idea, actually. I think that would be, you'd have to have won at least one audience prize. They're not going to do anything. They're not going to change it.
Well, the other race that's interesting to follow right now, because there's just a lot of unknown variables, is the documentary one. I mean, the Alex Gibney documentary in Scientology. It came back into theaters a couple weeks ago. That's still sort of around. There's The Look of Silence, but that didn't do that well when it came out over the summer. There's an Amy Berg movie, Prophet's Prey. I mean,
which did not get submitted for Doc. It didn't get accepted by Doc NYC. Doc NYC is an interesting. It's interesting to me that there's a single man, a person named Tom Powers, who is
definitely going to listen to this
programmer for the Toronto Film Festival, and therefore you know has an impact on what gets booked there, and for Doc NYC, which has a short list of 15 docs that they've culled for the whole year. And the overlap between that list and the list that ends up being the top 15 for the Oscars, the short list for the Oscars, is often very close, you know?
Right.
And they've picked the winner they've booked, in other words, in that list of 15, they have booked the Oscar winner for the last 3 years in a row. So the fact that Prophet's Prey, that doesn't mean statistically that something that isn't on their list can't get ahead. It can. And I was sort of surprised that they didn't include Listen to Me, Marlin or Prophet's Prey, but it's not a good sign.
No, and it just doesn't seem like there's one movie that's standing out as a rock star, except for the movie about a rock star of sorts, a pop star really, Amy, because it was a huge theatrical success, and because people like those kinds of movies, the showbiz movie. I mean, 20 Feet from Stardom obviously was the last example of that. But
there is a difference between, I mean, there is a difference between the process of the Academy Doc Branch picking the movies that are actually going to be on that that are going to be on that shortlist and the final five, as opposed to the mainstream Academy, which votes for the winner. So you could think that the people that voted for 20 Feet from Stardom or Searching for Sugar Man, it's not the same. So the Academy group is actually much more demanding and tough. And I just wonder how many of those music docs are going to get in. They're probably going to pick one. And would they pick Amy, or would they pick Kurt Cobain? You know,
right.
how do we know which one they're going to like the best?
Well, I think it would be pretty dramatic if they went for the Kurt Cobain doc over Amy Winehouse, but I like that movie too. And they're both sort of reliant on archival footage in a particular way. They're both dealing with people who died at the same age and sort of were overwhelmed by stardom and so forth. So it's a very specific kind of showdown that you're talking about.
So I would think that the Alex Gibney doc, for example, about Scientology would sort of trump the Amy Berg doc about these Mormon crazies, which is a very disturbing movie.
Yeah.
But somehow I think more people have responded to the Gibney doc.
So what do we expect from Michael Moore? His movie got distribution from a new company.
Yes, it's going to come out in time. I think it's going to be a success at the box office. I think it's a populist movie. And I think He Named Me Malala, which opened very well, is a populist movie. That isn't the same thing as gaining respect from your peers in the documentary branch.
Yeah,
so that
will
be the question.
He Named Me Malala, maybe it's a populist movie. I just didn't think it was particularly well made. And the Michael Moore movie is, I think, much more polished in a sense. It was a Michael Moore movie. Where to Invade Next is Michael Moore running around doing his thing, but it's fun, and it's done in a way that plays well to crowds. I think it did do well at New York Film
Festival. Argument there. I agree, and I think it played well in New York, and Toronto. But I think will his peers decide that this is a worthy of an Oscar? That's the question.
And will this anonymous new company that Tom Quinn and Jason Janego are starting with Tim League be able to do the right stuff to get it out there?
I'm sure they know what to do. I'm sure it'll do well. I'm sure it'll do well at the box office. I'm less sure of its Oscar potential.
But is Michael Moore not like, does the Academy not like him anymore? I mean, he was the head of the branch, what, like 2 or 3 years ago, right?
I would say to you that a lot of the people I've spoken to, a lot of them will grudgingly admit that all the rules changes that he pushed through, which include everybody seeing all the films, and it's no longer these little committees, and they don't have to see all 130 movies or however many it turns out to be. They're supposed to see 20% of them, but he pushed through those changes, and I think he did a good thing, and a lot of people admit that he did a good thing, but they didn't enjoy it while he was doing it. I think they experienced him a lot of them did experience him in a sort of negative way.
And now he has to deal with the backlash on that.
That's it, yeah.
Revenge of sorts. It's funny because I went to one of those lunches, that the awards lunches that they do in New York that Peggy Siegel organizes. This happened to be for end of the tour, and I was sitting next to an older gentleman who was an Academy member and a screenwriter but hadn't written a movie in a really long time, and he had not seen the movie for this lunch, but got a chance to shake Jason Segel's hand and got a screener when he left the lunch, and it just makes me wonder how arbitrary this process can be when you really get down to it. You don't expect all these people to watch all these movies. There's so many environmental factors and relationships to different people that end up having maybe an even bigger impact than the movies themselves.
So. There's a reason why they do all of these lunches and dinners, and they just woo these people. It's a finite group of people. Everybody knows exactly who they are. They get them to come out, and they wine and dine them, and that's part of the process.
It's just the nature of the industry. Well, I want to close this week's episode by getting away from all of that stuff, just to say a quick word about Chantal Ackerman, who unfortunately passed away at 65 this past week, just a couple of days before her latest and now last movie, No Home Movie, screened at New York Film Festival. Now, I did see this movie at Locarno over the summer where it had its world premiere, and not everybody has seen a lot of Chantal Ackerman films in this part of the world. Not everybody has been on that train, as it were, in support of her work. But this is a filmmaker who's starting with her very first movie, was constantly experimenting with the possibilities of time and identity on screen, and her relationship to being a presence in a movie or not in the movie at all was constantly in flux, and she inspired people in all kinds of different ways that have been celebrated across the internet. But at the New York Film Festival in particular, that kind of ecosystem that happens as a result of the festival, you could feel that impact everywhere. I did a conversation with Athena Rachel Sangari, the filmmaker in residence at the festival this year, and at the very end, somebody in the audience asked her to talk about women filmmakers she admires, and she just said Chantal Ackerman and couldn't continue. And across the hall, Amy Taubin was talking about encountering Chantal Ackerman before a screening of the new film in the 70s and being sort of impressed by how she was inspired on the one hand by Godard and on the other hand by Jonas Mika's Diary films, and how interesting that fusion was. And there were, you know, Philippe Garrel introduced his new movie and talked about Chantal Ackerman. And it's rare to see somebody who can have that kind of direct impact on so many different people in a creative community. And one of the things that's kind of remarkable about all of this is that No Home Movie in some ways speaks directly to the challenge of being successful and yet still trapped in your own kind of emotional challenges. It's about her watching her mother die, and it's just a really powerful kind of experience that is now also, as Jay Hoberman wrote in the New York Times this week, devastating. But the movies are still there, and if people haven't seen Chantal Ackerman movies, I'm not going to say this isn't a great time to catch up, but it is an important body of work that's worth paying attention to if you know movies, and Hulu has made them all available for free this weekend, so it's in that sense, it is an ideal opportunity to catch up. So I think
the thing that's really sad is that she ended up leaving the world at just about the moment where she'd never been an accessible filmmaker. She'd always been appreciated by a certain coterie of very sophisticated people, mainly in Europe. And I think it's sad that perhaps her most accessible work is not, she wasn't around to appreciate the response to it.
Right, but that response could be just starting, so hopefully we'll have more opportunities to revisit No Home Movie in the you know, weeks and months and years to come. So next week we'll regroup. You'll be back in Los Angeles, and I won't have to worry about the New York Film Festival for another year, and we can just keep moving ahead.
All right, talk to you later.
Have a good time out there.
Thanks. Bye.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.